Therefore, being widowed, they produced from themselves the hero race, the race of the initiates that were to restore the truth. These are the Heshesbi, or the Golden Hawks of Egypt, who were to avenge the death of Osiris and restore him to glory. In other words, to restore the full secret of the ancient mystery rites. All of these rites were imperfect, and in every one of them it was stated that a word, a symbol, a great emblem of power was lost. The search for this lost thing is represented in the precipitation of the entire race of the Volsung. Sigurd, or Siegfried, then, has not only the meaning of the hero being, but it is also the symbol of the human soul, which is the widow's son. And this human soul must ultimately conquer the body and must finally rise in victory over the material world. But when this soul is betrayed by the mind and is led into ways of materiality, it is said to enter the house of the Gibichung, where it takes the, or is drugged with the wine of forgetfulness, forgets its heavenly bride or its celestial mate, Brunhilde, and leads itself into a series of confusions which ultimately result in not only the death of Siegfried, but the great immolation scene in which Brunhilde takes her own life. All of these episodes are highly psychological and have to do with the entire compound structure of the human psychic life. Now, we've already mentioned that Odin, in his effort to accomplish his own end, precipitated the five generations of the Volsung. The mind, in order to attain its particular purpose, caused to emerge from itself the five senses. And the five senses, in turn, are what Buddha called the machine of the senses, by means of which the illusion of self-security or self-existence is perpetuated indefinitely. In the book of Revelation, we have a further development of this concept on another level, and we find that all of these symbols, the seals of Revelation, the churches of Asia, and all of these things have to do with levels of illumination or internal self-discipline. And that actually, the fifth of these levels, the one which corresponds to Sigurd in this story, corresponds with the fifth chakra of Raja Yoga. And this fifth chakra is placed in the throat, and it is the chakra which has to do with speech, with voice, and with the intonation of the sacred word. A speech symbol, or a sound symbol, which Wagner attempts to capture in the mysterious and curiously constructed trumpet call, which is constantly present with Sigurd as part of his identification. We find the hero, then, mysteriously born without knowledge of his own destiny, moved inevitably through the great course, which is to lead him finally to his death. He floats down the river Rhine, passing through numerous adventures and numerous incidents, until finally he comes to the place in which the tragedy is to be completed. Here we have another important group of symbols. Of course, as we go on with this study, we find another possible clue to the concept of the cyclic power of the ring. The ring, of course, is actually the Buddhist wheel of life. The ring is also the symbol of rebirth and of all the whole cycle of attendant consequences which have to do with re-embodiment. For the journey of the soul, the Rhine journey, is the soul journey of man, not only a journey through the years of a life, nor the journey of the descent of races, but the journey of the soul itself in space, searching for some solution to its own existence. Up to the present time, Wagner is pessimistic. He has seen this journey lead man only finally to the house of the Gibichung. And by going back again to the old Eddas and Sagas, we can get a much better understanding of this. What we call always in our way of thinking now, this place, that where we are at present, is always the end of the journey up to now. Therefore, our present contemporary way of life is the court of the Gibichung. It is a rather fine, splendid looking establishment, and Siegfried, as a symbol of the evolving humanity coming into this place, forms an alliance of blood brotherhood with the prince or chief of the house. Everything is done to make his stay pleasant and to make his visit one to bring happiness and festivity and rejoicing to everyone. And the wonderful little scenes which accompany the reception of Siegfried and all the things about it are just a little reminiscent, perhaps, of the celebrations which accompany the birth of the human being. Everyone is so glad he has arrived. He forms a happy alliance. He is a welcome guest in the house. And everyone more or less agrees to do all that is possible to make life enjoyable and happy for him, except one, Hagen. Hagen will not bind himself with blood brotherhood to anybody. Hagen just simply sits and knows that every being that comes into the world may be the promised hero who will overthrow selfishness and end the realm and reign of deceit. So Hagen is ever watchful, and his ancestor Albrecht whispers to him that the visitor who has come might and should be and is this hero of the world. So that the hero self in man must be destroyed or he is not safe. Emerson summarizes perhaps the moral of this when he says, all the world is at hazard when God lets loose a thinker. In other words, the newborn being, the human being, the humanity in man, the hero soul, always threatens the survival and the ambition of the dark, brooding form of Hagen. And Hagen is this strange collective evil in the world, the strange weight and pressure of old tradition, the status in quo that must never be interfered with, the brooding monuments of the past which dominate our lives and which settle down to the quiet task of destroying us. Hagen represents the world opposed to the soul. He represents the skill, the power, the cunning of the world as opposed to the principle of truth and right. He will not accept blood brotherhood with anyone. He will not give allegiance to anyone. But gradually this Hagen, who is the thrall of Gunther, becomes the bane of Sigurd. In other words, he becomes strangely his mortal enemy. Because it is a struggle to the death between the symbol of truth and the symbol of error. And Siegfried, while he represents only a conditioned symbol of truth, still is the threat. He is the one who must be destroyed in order that the plan of the Nibelung shall be achieved. He is the embodiment of the idealist who is forever a menace to the realism of our time. Wagner locks this situation in the house of the Gibichung, which is contemporary culture or contemporary civilization as we know it. A place which seemingly offers hospitality to all, but within which lurks this dark being who can be the friend to none, to whom friendship is unknown, and who was born of lovelessness and has been nursed by hate. Only one thing rules this thrall of Gunther, and that is the will to power. This is Schopenhauer's will to power, Nietzsche's will to power. This is the cult of the Superman, represented and personified in the descendants of the Nibelungen, who were little and dwarfed by nature, but by fortunate circumstance were able to conceal their deformity, but could never conceal the dark and shadowy evil of their souls. Here, then, is a conflict which arises in society, and which the legend carefully cultivates and makes available to us. Hagen has the entire world of natural magic available to him. And because of the word and advice and knowledge which he receives from his ancestor, Alberic, he has learned to know the secrets of art. And from the offended Brunhilde, he learns of the vulnerability of Sigurd. He learns, for example, that Sigurd the Dragon Slayer, the St. George of Cappadocia, the same dragon slayer as Izduba, who slew the ancient Babylonian dragon, that this symbol of the dragon slayer achieves a kind of immortality by bathing in the blood of the dragon. And Sigurd did this, and all parts of his body were invulnerable, except one place, where a leaf fell upon his back, a leaf of a tree, the tree of fate, and that this leaf left him vulnerable in one place. And it is in this one place, which was vulnerable like the heel of Achilles, that Hagen, having discovered the secret, thrust the lance which destroyed Sigurd. All this is part of the same general theme, namely that man becoming invincible by bathing himself in the blood of material power and earthliness is still vulnerable. There is still always a part or place which is not protected. A man, no matter how completely he builds around himself the wall of his own closed-mindedness, of his own dedication to materialism and everything that it represents, no individual can achieve immortality by the power of the mind or of reason. No matter how strong we become, we are not safe. No matter how learned we become, we are not happy. Always in this strange mortal tragedy, man seeking immortality must die. It goes on to unfold the fatal phases of the story. Now let us go back again into the cosmic side of it for a moment and see what was supposed to be happening in space during the time in which the great closing cycle of the Götterdämmerung was taking place. It seems that fate, a mysterious symbol represented by three sisters, the Norns, who are forever braiding and unbraiding, tying and untying, weaving and unweaving the threads of destiny, that these three mysterious dark sisters are aware of the fact that there is a strange and inevitable destiny that shapes our ends, rough-hew them though we may. And gradually the gods, realizing that the great plan of the heroes is failing, that it is only a matter of time before Hagen, representing the complete embodiment of the adversary, will achieve his purpose, set themselves quietly upon their ancient thrones and wait in complete resignation, hopeless and profound, for the coming of Ragnarok, the twilight of the gods. And the signs which lead to this terrible occasion are found to be present in all parts of the universe. For when the great day comes, the warning will be blown by the trumpeter of heaven who stands guarding the bridge of rainbows which connect heaven and earth. This is Hindau, the keeper of the great trumpets. And he is the one that lets the gods know that the night is coming. And how do they know this? Because slowly all of the great bonds of magic, the runes which they whispered, the spells which they cast, all these strange and wonderful things begin to unwind and fall apart. And it seems that Loki, the god of fires, the Lucifer of this pantheon, who had been bound under the earth with a serpent dropping venom upon him, Loki broke his bonds and dashed forth, ravaging upon the earth. And the great wolf, Fenris, came out of the darkness, howling and with fangs bared. And the ship of lost souls came out of the underworld, a ship made of the fingernails of the damned. And on this were ghosts and demons and monsters and all strange, hideous things. And as the gods waited, they felt the very world beneath them shaking. For the worms, the horrible little things that had been gnawing at the roots of the tree of life, gnawed through the roots. And the great world tree, Yggdrasil, shook upon its foundations and shuddered. And one by one, all of the strange elementary forces of nature were loosed again. And then came the Ragnarok. Then came the Nordic version of the Armageddon. This was the last great war between the gods and the demons. And from every mysterious vastness of the underworld and of the far places came the monsters. The Midgard snake, which twisted around the earth in the oceans, shook forth from the sea and came crawling as a terrible monster upon the land. All these things were the omens, the forebodings of the end that was to come. And finally Hindal blew his great trumpet, and the gods came forth. And they came forth upon the plain of Ragnarok, before the walls of Valhalla and Asgard, and drew up their armies. And the armies of the gods consisted of the heroes that had been picked up by the Valkyrie from the fields of battle, the hero dead, whose souls would form the great army of the protectors. And against them came this great array of evil powers. And so the gods and the monsters were locked in a struggle to the death in a great battle. One by one the monsters were killed. One by one the gods died killing them. And even great All-Father himself perished in mortal combat with the monsters of darkness. And as the gods fell and their armies ceased, the great throne of Valhalla was shaken, and all the world, moved as by some terrible earthquake and tempest, collapsed into the great sea of space, collapsed, falling, until all parts of it were submerged except the peak of one mountain. One mountain remained above the deluge. For this was indeed the great flood that destroyed the world. And with the world went the gods and the demons to a common destruction. Everything perished together, except two mortals, a man and a woman, who had hidden themselves in this cave on the top of a mountain. And they became the progenitors of a new race, a new way of life. They were the ones who were saved. And from them came a world that no longer knew of the struggle of gods and demons, no longer knew of the old ways that had been. And after the great night of the gods, the sun rose upon this mountain peak and prepared the way for the salvation of the world. In the Sigurd saga, and as it is presented by Wagner, these factors all coincide with the closing scene of the Götterdämmerung. The entire episode is highly condensed, but its implications are quite clear. Siegfried is dead, lying upon the funeral pyre, wearing upon his finger the cursed ring of the Nibelung that he wore even in death. Every effort to take it from his finger had failed, because the thief, even as he reached for it, the hand closed upon it. It could not be removed even in death, for even in death man cannot forget his ambition to power. That, according to Buddhism, is why he must be reborn again. And so the funeral pyre is there, and Brunhilde appears, and mounting upon her white horse, after her great immolation scene, she rides into the funeral pyre to die with Siegfried. At the same time, the river Rhine rises, breaking through its banks by a strange flood, for this river Rhine is, of course, the German version of the great ocean into which the world fell. And as the river Rhine rises, the plaintive song of the Rhine maidens is heard. They are waiting, waiting for the return of the ring which is theirs. And in this last moment, Hagen makes his supreme effort. Dashing upon the scene, he finally succeeds in wrenching the ring from the dead fingers and jumps into the river to swim away with it. The Rhine maidens drag him down, down into the depths of the river, and he perishes, struggling to keep possession of the ring. Slowly the flames of the background rise higher and higher, and the stage setting implies that in their great palace the gods are waiting for the end. This is the great symbol of the fire that destroys the world, till it all falls together in the Nordic version into the Rhine, and nothing remains but the water going on and on, and the strange, mysterious theme of the Rhine music. This is the great tragedy of mankind, the tragedy of the fall of worlds and of empires, and the fall of human ambitions, and death cheating each individual of the glory of his worldly power. The ring finally returns to the Rhine, returns to the mysterious beings who keep it and to whom it rightfully belongs. But the long search for the treasure has been one great tragedy. Each person who touched it fated to die. Each one given the opportunity to return it and failing. At no time was it not possible by a single act of enlightened will to return the ring and break the curse. But no one did it. Each, for a different motive, held on to the ring. Some for pride, some because they were coaxed, and others simply because nature wanted it back. Just this strange orneriness of human beings, this unwillingness to do the thing that is simple and next. The ring, therefore, again, has a very important symbol. Any time in the growth of mankind, when man will return the government of power to its rightful owner, the universe will be at peace. The moment man obeys instead of disobeying, the moment he acknowledges that the ring belongs in the river, that it belongs in the keeping of the great Rhine King, as soon as man does not try to keep for himself that which can never be his own justly, as soon as man realizes this, he would break the curse of the ring. But he does not realize and will not accept. Again, this signifies the relaxation of the power mania, or the power complex. As soon as man, for instance, actually says in his own soul, "Not my will, but the divine will be done," the ring is returned to the river. The moment the individual accepts the laws of the universe, lives them, and no longer tries to build a world apart from them, as soon as man breaks this competitive spirit between himself and his universe, he will no longer be the subject of the great tragedy. the gods disobeyed and fell. And they paid ultimately for their disobedience in the blazing chaos of the Gotadamaran. Man disobeying pays for his disobedience upon the funeral pyre. But always the ring could be returned. Always it represents power which, if restored to the law, restored to the keeping of the great principles which guard it, restored to the Rhine maidens, who symbolize time as the dimensions of duration and dimensions as the elements of nature and of the formal universe, when this gold is returned to them, their power, their secret, and they can guard it in their own way, the curse ends. But it is never returned by man until he has paid for it with his own life. In the Eastern symbolism, the same type of parallel exists. Man can attain immortality only by returning his own individuality to the universal. He becomes immortal only when he casts from himself his own ego. When he returns to the sea of life his own individuality, he becomes universal. When he returns to infinite being, the finite nature of his own personal existence, he becomes infinite. If, therefore, he has the strange supreme wisdom to practice the mystery, he can then rescue not only himself, but the gods. For man rescuing consciousness from intellect restores the realms and powers of the celestial beings. Behind Odin is the pure mystery of consciousness itself. And we can pause again to consider another phase of this legend. In the very beginning, it is said, there was nothing but space. There was nothing but eternal being. And this eternal being, existing, surviving, going on forever, slowly a motion came within it. The motion of life. This was the primordial motion of the ring, because it is the nebula, the symbol of the rise of energy. And from primordial motion, space or eternity was divided into two parts, a superior and an inferior part. And the heavens, which were above the earth, were divided from the heavens which were beneath the earth. And in this beginning, then, were created the heavens and the earth, the above and the below, the superior and the inferior, reality and illusion, truth and error. And in the Nordic version, this division resulted in two great cliffs, two wonderful walls that seemed to rise up like the, perhaps we might imagine, the walls of the Grand Canyon of the Colorado. Two great walls. And between them, an immense abyss, a great cleft in space that went all the way down into the unfathomable abyss, because this cleft was cut with the sword of the gods, the sword that was later broken upon the spear of Sigmund, upon the spear of Wotan, was later mended and repaired by Sigurd, and became the mysterious sword of power, the same sword that we find in the Excalibur of King Arthur. This is the sword of enlightened purpose, or as the Hindu calls it in the Gita, take the sword of quick detachment and cut the snaky branches low, referring to the tree of illusion, or to the illusional world represented by the dragon and many other things. In any event, this sword cut the great cleft in space, which was called Ganungagap. And here was a great abyss. And on the cliffs and the walls on each side were giants, frost giants and flame giants. Those upon the north were of frost, and those of the south were of flames. And they cast their flames and their ice into the great abyss, and a great steam arose, what is called hoarfrost. And out of this was formed the body of Ymir, the frost giant, the primordial being, the great body of creation. Semi-animate, semi-inanimate, it writhed and twisted and moaned in space for ages. And this great body then produced from itself all kinds of strange beings. And among those things that came out of it was the great cow mother. And this cow mother found herself in a world of ice. And she licked the ice to get salt. And when she licked the ice, she licked out of it three gods who were frozen or imprisoned in it. And the chief of these was Odin. And Odin turned upon the great frost giant, Ymir, and slew it. And from the decaying body of this giant came forth strange maggot-like creatures that were to be animals and insects. And from its hair was created forests, and from its eyebrows the boundaries of the world. And its skull was raised upon the shoulders of four gnomes that were called Audrey, Sudri, Naudri, and Vestri, from which we have our north, east, south, and west. And the heavens were filled with clouds, which were the thoughts of Ymir, and the blood of Ymir were the sea and the rivers. And out of all parts of this primordial giant was fashioned the world, and over it ruled Odin. But Odin, mind, became ruler of a chaos which it had brought into existence by killing. It had destroyed this ancient primordial monster and usurped its power. Therefore, even in this early page, we find mind with its strange victory over chaos. Mind gradually organizing the universe, slaying the primordial force, organizing, integrating, creating, until it brought into existence human society. For what is society but a monument, a structure, based upon the foundations of the giant of savagery? What is all that we know except a fashioning of primitive things into things more recognizable and more apparently suitable to us? And Odin thus became the ruler of this mundane world, a world which he had fashioned with his skill, and which mind continues to fashion, and over which it rules with a frightened existence throughout the whole lapse of time. Thus the creation of the world follows the Orphic tradition, and it represents also the divisions within consciousness, divisions by which finally consciousness itself is obscured and lost in the creations which it supports. And if we go back to the instruction that was given to the novices in the old Gothic rites concerning these things, we shall find a great deal of very interesting and useful information. They all believe definitely that the supreme deity, the absolute ruler of all things, was this mysterious space, this formless, shapeless, eternal power that endured forever. They also held that this and this alone really existed. Everything else was subject to decline or change. Nothing was changeless but space. Nothing was immortal but space. And this strange space being, this strange space ever becoming, was the source of life, the reservoir of all energies and of all principles and of all powers. And while it slept on through its own great eternal rest, there was no death, there was no darkness, there was no decay. But in the course of ages, just as the rhythm of the ring meant that periodically the Rhine Gold came to life, so in the depths and eternity of space itself, there was a strange rhythm under the law of the Rhine King, or the Space King. And this rhythm meant that space periodically, spontaneously, became fruitful and caused to emerge from itself in what Plato calls the great cycles of alternate fertility and sterility. In the periods of fertility, space bore. It caused to come from itself the seminal principles of things. And from the great darkness and eternity of space came forth the twofold powers. And these, ether and chaos, according to the Greeks, represented the active and passive polarities of space. And from the minglings, confusings, and battlings of these two were formed the primordial giant of creation. Now, creation is not just our earth or our world. Creation is the gradual emergence of matter. And Yima, the frost giant, is the symbol of matter. Locking again within itself this inevitable mass of little minute seminal lives, which are referred to as maggots and crawling things. It is Odin's mind that slays the principle of matter and begins the process of molding matter into form. And this form world is born between the two great polar cliffs of the Ganunga Gap, and is represented by alternate currents of electrical and magnetic energy. And mind, or the world intellect, corresponding to the Greek deity Zeus, begins to fashion the mundane sphere out of the ashes of the giants and the blood of Bacchus. It is a strange, mysterious production, and out of this mystery comes something, form. And form is the great compound. And is the reason, perhaps, for the lines upon the supposed monument of Lord Bacon at St. Albans, the final observation of a wise man, "Let all compounds be dissolved." The moment there is compound, dissolution is inevitable. The moment things exist in patterns, these patterns are vulnerable, because these patterns are held together by energy, by a particular and special kind of effort called in India will or yoga. And this means that all forms exist only because of consciousness concentrated upon them, holding them together, binding them, serving as a perpetual binder of their particles and elements. The moment consciousness is relaxed, form disappears, returning again to its primordial elements, just as the body, after the soul has departed, returns again to the earth from whence it came. Thus, compounds are preserved only because they are enlivened, because they are ensouled by an agent greater than themselves. And wherever this ensouled power exists, greater than that which it ensouls, it can be separated from it. And whenever this separation takes place, compounds are dissolved. Therefore, the whole world and all the mysteries of it, all the strange pageantries and shapes which it supports, all these things are held together by the power of mind. A strange, mysterious agent. This mind can will them into existence. This mind can maintain them with its thought. This mind can decide for them a great and future destiny. But if this mind ever sleeps, if this mind ever rests, if this mind ever turns its attention from this project, these things dissolve and become truly like the insubstantial pageantry of a dream. So the gods hold the world in the grasp of mental energy. And by mental energy, Votan becomes the sovereign intellect of the world. By mental energy, he seeks to scheme its perpetuation. For man, who is an embodiment of mind, is forever scheming his own perpetuation. He wants the institutions that he has to go on. He wants the deeds that he has done to be remembered. He wants those who come after him to know that he has lived. And he also wishes to burden, if possible, the unborn future with his opinions, his convictions, his beliefs. And he is making laws today which he hopes will bind the ages. And yet, in a single instant, this man, this mind ceases. And when a man passes out of this life, it does not seem to him that he dies, but that the world dies. Inasmuch as in this single action, he has removed his attention or his mental focus from a sphere of activity, and that activity fades away as though it never existed. So man, building with mind, builds this tremendous hero saga, creating for himself the concept of the world hero that is the embodiment of adequate mind. This mind is ultimately going to master everything. This mind, taking form in the arts and sciences and its numerous heroes, is going to save the world. It is going to bring the perfect civilization. It is going to end economic imbalance. It is going to ultimately bring about the arbitration of wars. It is going to improve and perfect United Nations and Hague conferences and Geneva conferences until all things are solved. It is going to make available to man all things necessary to man, and is to build a perfect world for him. So mind becomes the symbol of an heroic program. And this mind is indeed the embodiment or the symbol of the hero race. For man is the hero, who up to now has exploited every other part of nature shamefully, but still looks forward to rightful possession of that which he has woefully abused. So man goes on, thundering down through the ages, and the institutions which he builds never change. Here we are after 5,000 years of archaic education, and yet today, the moment we try to change anything, progress is blocked. We must go on. We must do it our way, because like the hero Siegfried, we hear the voice of the Rhine Maidens pleading with us to return the gold, to return the ring. We have already experimented with the mystery of the Tarnhelm and all the magic works of science worked in the laboratory of the Nibelung. We have learned tragedy after tragedy, but when we feel within ourselves that the universe wants us to obey, to return these powers to the keeping of spirit rather than locking them within the embrace of ambition, we close ourselves. We will not return the ring. We will not return the human spirit to God. We will not bring it back to obedience. We will not help it to be replaced in the great stream of life, the Tao, by which it might move victoriously on through time. We are the children of a rebel angel, and we are destined and determined to build our empire in the abyss that shall rival the empire of heaven. And so by self-will we die, even as by universal will we are redeemed. So this is the story of the whole pageantry of the conflict between self-will and universal will. Self-will, first personified by Odin, keeps on extending through the creations of self-will, the ingenious methods for making this go on regardless, and finally, the ultimate tragedy of self-will. For that which lives by will must die by will, and that which won its way by the sword must perish by the sword. These laws are in the keeping of someone greater. And behind all these things lurks the strange, quiet, mysterious form of Erda, the great oracular earth herself. And in the sagas and Eddas, Erda plays a great part because she is nature. And Odin at times calls upon her and pleads with her to tell him the secret of his own fate. And in the ancient sagas, it is Erda who always suffers as the result of the things that men do. Because in doing these selfish, ambitious things, men hurt nature. Men break the laws of nature. Men are therefore raised in rebellion against her. But nature, ever quiet, ever silent, knows that her ways will be ultimately accepted. So Erda waits in patience, always waiting for men to come to nature to learn the truth, seeking not within their own ambitions, but within the soul and life of things. Nature teaches by experience. Nature is the oracle, and is ever tracing the true answers to mysteries. And Erda beseeches them to come and learn her ways and be truly wise. So Odin goes to her and pleads with her, and she instructs him. But he is proud, and he turns from nature and goes back to his own ambitions. Man also, listening to the voice of nature, watching around him, could learn as Lao Tzu learned, that by silent receptivity to the magnificent message of natural processes, men could be truly wise. But they turn from nature to the works of their own ingenuity. Men no longer live with nature. They live in cities and towns where they can no longer see the sunrise or the sunset. Nature has become something strange, distant, remote, and inconsequential. Their own works have become magnificent monuments to be adored. So man, worshipping his own mistakes down through the ages, venerating them, adoring them, and copying them, goes ever further from the keeping of ancient Erda, who alone, perhaps, of all creatures, really knows the answer. And, of course, she is not telling it to arrogant men. She is saving it, perhaps, for those two little people who were hidden in the cave and upon whom the future destiny of the earth must depend. So Erda is the great oracle, oracle of nature, the oracle of true wisdom, which is so simple that Odin cannot understand. So all the elements of this story fit together and make a wonderful account of actions and reactions, of processes and forces, of the strivings of space and time. And like most other scriptural writings, they conceal in wonderful patterns truths that are eternal and profoundly significant. Out of many of these elements, Wagner has combined the elements of his music dramas. But there is no question in the world that he was emphasizing primarily one phase, and that was this ethical story of the struggle of man against the productions of his own selfish instincts. That man, representing the true hero of the world, is floating inevitably to his own doom down the river Nile in his strange little ship, down the river Rhine in his strange little ship. Floating to his fatal meeting with the Gibbethon, floating to the final embrace with materialism, in which accepting ultimately materialism as absolutely real, forming a blood brotherhood with matter instead of with spirit, comes inevitably under the watchful eye of Hagen, who is resolved through selfishness to possess the treasures of the human soul. And Hagen, representing the secret power ruling materialism, will conspire always to bring about the death of the hero, as materialism gave Socrates the cup of hemlock, Christ the cross, and Muhammad the poison of Kaaba. In every case, the great materialism closing in upon consciousness is a murderer. If it does not murder the body, it tortures the soul. If it does not destroy man immediately, it destroys him eventually by indoctrinating him with false teachings which bring him finally to destruction and death. This is the burden of Wagner's approach. But he does intimate in the closing notes of his great ritual the hope of the better day. Can the new race which is to come survive? Can the daughter who died trampled to death by horses, the daughter of Siegfried, mysteriously point the way to another race? According to the ancient writings, there must be a sixth race, a sixth child of the Volsung. We do not know who it is. But when we go into the Parsifal story, we are going to look around a little and see what we can locate. But there must be six of these orders of descent. and then finally the seventh, which is the Sabbath, the day of rest, the day of the atonement and the achievement. The struggle of life through the 6 days of creation must ultimately be consummated in the victory of the seventh. The sixth generation appears in the ancient Volsung saga in the form of these two little people of unknown origin who were saved. And if we are to find the answer to this mystery, we will search further, because we will almost certainly find that these two little people also, in some strange way, were of the blood of the Volsung. They have to be, because the story has to go on. It is the drama of life and of nations, of peoples, of races, of worlds, and of man's struggle to achieve for himself permanence, security, in a world where these do not exist. Therefore, he must fail until he listens to the voices of the Norns and of Erda, the Great Mother, amends his ways, returns the ring, breaks the curse, and saves not only himself, but the gods. How this is accomplished is really rather well set forth in the story of Parsifal and the Grail. For as the ring is the Old Testament of the Wagnerian cycle, so the Grail story is the New Testament. And these together form the Law and the Prophets, the two dispensations as represented in the great mythological mystery systems of the ancients upon which Wagner drew for his inspiration. Now, I think our time is up for this evening, so we hope to meet with you.